What is greenhouse gas?
What is climate change?
When all the adults put too much greenhouse gases and cut down all the trees.
Burning coals. We need to reduce that. How are we going to do that?
Listen to Beyond Zero for news, commentary and solutions. 8:30 a.m. Fridays on your community radio, 3CR.
What's going to happen to the frogs?
Good morning and welcome to the Beyond Zero show on 8:55 a.m. 3CR. If you're looking for the Stick Together show, it's now on Sundays at 10 a.m. You're here with Matthew and Miwa. Good morning, Miwa. We do. We've got a fantastic guest. We've got Wislaw Malczewski from the U.S. Postgraduate Naval School. We might have him there on the line right now. Are you there, Dr. Malczewski?
Yes, correct. Good morning.
Good morning. We're speaking to you today about the situation with the Arctic ice. As our listeners are aware, that's a very serious situation and well ahead of estimates by scientists some years ago, and by science that's led to sort of summaries in the IPCC stuff. We're seeing by 2020, or there's a quote from Wislaw that perhaps 2013 is even a possibility for the loss of the complete summer ice extent. Now, a little bit about Dr. Malczewski. He's got a PhD at the University of Alaska in 1994. He is in charge of a group that looks after a particular model that simulates the Arctic ice, and I think it has a 9 kilometer resolution, but that's over a very large area. In the past, he's worked in research areas in Arctic oceanography, numerical ocean and sea ice modelling, ocean general circulation and climate change. In 2001 to present, he's been a research associate professor at the Department of Oceanography. 1995 to 2001, he's the research assistant professor, Department of Oceanography, conducting reimbursable research, supporting student thesis research and teaching descriptive oceanography. So, good morning, Wislaw.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
No problem, and thank you for joining us. Just tell us a little bit about your research work around modeling of the Arctic ice.
Well, I guess just trying to introduce in a very short time, I guess, what we've been doing for some last two decades or so. We're using mathematical models that are formulated in numerical programs using some programs that we're using Fortran programming language, so the computers can understand those programs. And we're using those programs that are describing the mathematical equations of the behavior of the ocean and the sea ice. And then we're actually prescribing to those models realistic atmospheric forcing, as has been observed from satellites and from various stations all over the world, and trying to eventually understand the past and the present conditions that have occurred in the Arctic Ocean. And by trying to understand that, maybe trying to have a better view and a picture of what to expect to come in the future.
So just tell me about the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. Is the funding for any sort of military purposes, or is it just general research?
Well, the Naval Postgraduate School, it's you can probably describe in summary, this is kind of like the only Navy university in the United States. We offer only graduate degrees, meaning master's degree and PhDs. There is a separate academy, Naval Academy in Annapolis, where they actually, the Navy officers and other military officers have a chance to pursue their bachelor undergraduate degree. So at this institution here in Monterey, California, we have graduate students, and there is a mix of faculty. The institution primarily is to eventually educate the Navy and other military personnel towards a higher degree education, specializing in technical and defense areas such as oceanography, meteorology, space engineering, and then we have departments of national securities and business administration and so on. We have international studies department. So this is kind of like a specific to the military and specifically to Navy needs a higher education institution equivalent to a university in the United States.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So in terms of what you've been reporting in the of what's happening in the Arctic, our understanding is that the Arctic ice shrank between 2005 and 2007 by a bit over 22%. And to put that in context for our listeners, it was over 1 million square kilometres, about the size of the Northern Territory in Australia. So if you think of that huge landmass we've got in the Northern Territory, that was the area. And our understanding is that when the Arctic ice extent is fully covered, light coming in from space hits the ice and 80% of that reflects back into the atmosphere, so it doesn't convert into heat inside the Earth's greenhouse or inside the Earth's atmosphere. So just correct me if I'm wrong here. Just one more thing that's of interest there is that once the ice melts away, 90% of the light coming in through the atmosphere actually converts to heat inside the atmosphere and heats the ocean. Is that correct?
Well, there are several issues that you brought up which are quite important probably to clarify, and you tried to describe them quite correctly, I guess. The first thing is that the observations of the ice extent, you can think about actually flying a plane or a high altitude instruments on satellites and trying to determine basically where the white is and where the black being the ocean surface without ice cover is. And those observations have been very, quite good quality since late 1970s with the introduction of the microwave satellites such as ERS-1 and ERS-2 in Europe and several other satellites, SSMI satellites in the United States. So we have from observations, this is not my studies in particular, this is the U.S. and European and other space agency programs that allow us to have a picture or a view in time on evolution of the changes of the ocean and sea ice surface, including polar regions, not only in the Northern Hemisphere, but also in the Southern Hemisphere as well. The same satellites are quite accurately observing and providing information of the Southern Ocean and the Antarctic ice sheet. So those observations are not actually particular results of our studies. What we're trying to do is just we're using those observations to eventually feed into the models that we're using or people are using. And on top of this also, those observations are very useful for validating more model results that people like our group or other groups are doing. And in order to understand the interactions and feedbacks between ocean ice and atmosphere and various other components of the climate system in a particular region, one needs to have some ways of at least convincing himself or herself and other people that at least at some areas where observations are available, the skill of such models is pretty reasonable. So what we do with the ocean and ice simulations with the prescribed realistic atmospheric forcing, we're trying to validate the models with available observations from satellites and in-situ field observations, and then eventually look at parameters that are not readily available from observations to fill up the gaps of the missing information and probably synthesize this information together with observations to eventually come up with a bigger picture evolving in time and space. So what we're doing, we're actually simulating the sea ice and the ocean in interaction with the atmosphere, and the satellites are very good instruments providing aerial observations of the Arctic sea ice, which is, as I mentioned, basically, the satellites see where the ice is, being a lot of reflectivity from the ice surface due to a parameter called ice albedo or surface albedo, which is simply a ratio of what the incoming solar radiation versus what the reflected solar radiation. So reflectivity or ice albedo is high where you have sea ice and the surface is white. For the ocean, the surface is really dark and the reflectivity goes down, meaning that most of the solar radiation is absorbed by the ocean and not reflected back to the atmosphere. And the consequences of this are several, but I'm not sure if we have time to eventually go into details describing all the possible consequences of the changing surface albedo and the surface cover in the Arctic.
Yeah, we do have another 15 minutes left in the show, so we can get into some depth there. But just for listeners, when the sea ice cover is lost, and we're talking about what 5 million square kilometres is what the average was for say 1979 to 2002. Is that about right?
I believe it was close to 7 million.
Oh, 7 million square kilometres. And in Australia, we have a rough benchmark. We say that for every square metre, 1,000 watts. So that's like like 10 100-watt light globes every hour. 1,000 watts of energy actually hits the surface of the land. Is that a similar situation in the Arctic, or with the sun in the Arctic, is there a lot of cloud cover and that sort of balances it out? But it's a lot of energy.
A lot of cloud cover, so it's not direct solar radiation. It's more dispersed solar radiation, but it's very important. I would prefer not to put a number because actually I'm not an atmospheric scientist, so I'm not actually feeling comfortable to talk about the solar radiation and the effect in the atmosphere. But the point is that it's the primary forcing coming from the sun and the atmosphere in terms of wind. So those two parameters, or those two particular forcing terms, have been quite extensively looked into their effect on the Arctic sea ice and the recent changes in the Arctic sea ice. What our group at the Naval Postgraduate School here brings a new perspective to this table, to this understanding, is that we argue that we also have to consider the effect coming from the ocean. And the effect from the ocean is actually, you already mentioned that by removing sea ice, the ocean absorbs much more energy from the sun than the sea ice with its very high reflectivity. So it's not only that we absorb more solar radiation, but also the solar radiation heats the top surface of the ocean, which then eventually this heat in the surface ocean or the top upper part of the ocean becomes available in the longer term for affecting the ice from underneath, simply melting it. So our contribution to this overall studies of the Arctic sea ice decrease is that we are arguing that the oceanic forcing indirectly receiving heat and the momentum or the motion from the atmosphere actually pretty much changes the time and space scale of exchanges and interactions and ice response, and then eventually provides pretty much a separate forcing to the sea ice condition.
Okay, so now it was reported in the New York Times that you said that 2013 was a possibility, and perhaps you'd actually projected this some years ago, that we could lose the summer sea ice extent. So that's in the summer solstice, is it?
That is correct.
And that's
so the minimum in the Arctic ice extent has been typically occurring sometime in September, between early September and late September every summer. So the minimum of ice extent is simply defined as the ice edge of percentage, roughly say between 15, maybe at 20% ice cover, and then everything inside this ice edge position on the Atlantic side and on the Pacific side is considered to be the ice extent. So it's not really concentration. It's just the area within the 15% or 20% ice concentration or more. And this ice minimum has been declining quite significantly. The global climate models have predicted, you probably, and your audience is probably familiar with this International Panel for Climate Change Study Annual Report 4 that has been published and presented quite extensively this year, earlier this year in 2007. And actually the panel, together with President Al Gore, have won the Nobel Prize nomination. So those studies from this panel, the multinational climate simulation studies, have predicted the ice might be disappearing in summer, northern summer in the Arctic, maybe sometime by the end of the 21st century. There are some model simulations, single model simulation, that are suggesting that it could possibly occur as early as 2050 or maybe even as early as 2030. So comparing those model simulation predictions with satellite observations or of the Arctic sea ice extent actually shows that none of those, most of the models are too conservative predicting the current and the past ice extent changes in the Arctic, as has been observed. So the idea is that those climate models, they are underestimating, they're too conservative in their predictions. What our contribution, our study contribution to this overall topic is that we're saying that the satellites are only observing the two-dimensional changes in the sea ice in the Arctic in terms of this ice extent. However, we do not have the observations of ice thickness, the third dimension, the vertical dimension, are very limited of the Arctic sea ice. And having those models that we use, we are able to look at the changes associated not only with the ice extent, but also ice thickness, and this way we can eventually calculate and try to understand the changes in the total ice volume in the Arctic. And our studies are suggesting that actually the volume and the thickness is decreasing even faster than the aerial observations from satellites. And this way we're saying that actually if we already have lost probably about 40% volume in the Arctic so far, if we project this trend ongoing for the last 10, 15 years, we probably will hit zero in summer sometime mid-next decade.
So, yeah, so there's been other projections from some glaciologists around 2020. So somewhere in that range, you said 2013 in the New York Times where it was reported. But so something between then and 2020 is a very in the ballpark and a likelihood.
Well, it's interesting that the longer we wait and the more we see what is happening, what changes are happening in the Arctic, the sooner people start predicting those changes to completely melt ice in summer in the Arctic as soon as within next decade or so.
I think there's a lot of inertia that's lacking because until I think there's a conservatism and a lot of scientists are a bit afraid of being seen to be alarmist or something like that. So it's now that the observed is there on record that suddenly everyone who's got a prediction seems to be coming out now, or perhaps it is that the media are just getting interested.
I think the media is getting definitely much more interested, and the society is trying to understand what is happening out there, not only in the Arctic, but also the ice shelf around Antarctica and so forth. So definitely the interest and demand for information is much higher than a couple years ago. My statement on that you quoted and was printed in New York Times of 2013, my first presentation where I actually had this projection stated explicitly was about 4 or 5 years ago in San Francisco, the American Geophysical Union fall meeting. So I'm not actually upgrading my projections. I'm just saying that it might happen sooner, but we were one of the early people who were saying that it might happen within the next decade instead of by the end of the next this century.
Yeah, and that's definitely of concern because in Australia, of course, fortunately, and I'm sure that you think this is a good thing, our country's decided now to ratify the Kyoto Protocol with the change of government, and currently in Bali, they're now starting to talk about nothing like what we believe needs to occur, and that's to take all our industrial emissions down to near zero emissions and then start actively drawing down atmospheric carbon using getting char and carbon into soils. But I think it's really really good to see that Indonesia and China are calling for 25 to 40% cuts in CO2. And what do you think needs to happen in order to sort of preserve the ice extent? I think James Hansen from NASA has suggested that might be one of the main sort of triggers or the main tipping points, and that maintaining that summer ice extent might be very important for keeping a rather stable stable sort of climate that supports many of the ecosystems and many of the people who are living on Earth who are dependent on them.
Well, personally, I have my own perspective on all the carbon emissions and global warming. However, I wanted to make very clear that the tools that we have used so far for our studies, they're not involving or allowing us to discriminate between greenhouse gases effect or other climate variability. So what we see is what we see, but there is no direct cause. There is no possibility for us to link direct cause of ice melt to something like greenhouse gases. My personal perspective is that we definitely should be cutting on the emission rates worldwide, and it may not stop whatever the changes are happening right now, but we are still not very certain what kind of changes we can expect, not only within the next 10 years, but within the 20, 50 years into the future. So if we sit and do nothing, definitely it will be much worse than if we try to actually reduce our pollution and emissions of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere for the long term.
So another area that sort of gets this in sort of visualizes it for our listeners, and I will just say that listeners are tuned into 8:55 a.m. 3CR, and you're listening to the Beyond Zero show, and we're talking to Vaislav Maslowski. For listeners, we just suggested that an area the size of the Northern Territory potentially could be going from a mirror that reflects 80% of the light back into space, or there's some variability there in the amount of light because of cloud cover and things like that, but it's still a large area, a very large area, and listeners in Australia know how big the Northern Territory is. If that then extends to the whole of the Arctic, I think ice extent, and you said that at one stage it was 7 million square kilometres, well, that's pretty much the size of Australia. So some sort of a mirror with some level of reflectivity the size of Australia, that's certainly a large albedo effect. So tell us about that again, but also about the ice thickness and what you've seen there, because I think it's gone from 5 meters to 2 meters in many places, or?
Well, the average ice thickness as observed from satellites and more accurately from the submarines that carry instrument called upward-looking sonar. So it's something like a video camera that is looking up from the submarine below, looking underneath the sea ice. And the typical ice thickness in the Arctic, central basin in the Arctic, was on the average about 3 to 4 meters for the last decades. What we have seen in the last decade, this thickness has on average decreased to below 2 meters, roughly 35 to 40%, probably. If we would have a most recent observations of the summer 2007, I would argue that we probably lost more than 40% by now, by the summer of 2007. So the ice thickness is declining even faster than what we have observed and detected using satellites in terms of the ice extent in the Arctic Ocean. As far as the changes in the albedo and changing the mirror into the totally absorbing ocean surface, there's two aspects of that I'd like to bring to the audience there and your attention as well. One aspect actually is that if you have warmer water, the volume will actually expand a little bit. And I just recently listened to several presentations by sea level people, scientists studying sea level for the past and the future. And apparently on the order of 50% of the current sea level increase, it can be credited to the changes in the ocean surface temperatures, not necessarily the addition of new volume of water. So if we increase the temperature in the Arctic, we might see some increases in the sea level due to simply increasing the temperature. The sea ice melting is not going to introduce new volume because it's already floating in the ocean. So the volume of ice is already accounted in terms of the sea level. But the change of the sea level due to the increased temperature from freezing temperatures of order of minus 2 degrees centigrade, if we go to zero or above zero centigrade, the ocean is going to expand at least a bit. The other aspect of the no ice in summer in the Arctic is actually its potential effect on melting the Greenland glaciers flowing into the ocean. We already have seen, and I've listened to several people presentations where they discussed that potential effect of warmer surface water entering glaciers and melting the ice flowing out into the glaciers from Greenland might be actually accelerating the flow from the central Greenland towards the coast. So there are two aspects that this change in the ice cover in the Arctic might have immediate effect on.
And we're going to have to wrap it up now, but that was actually my last question. It was, you know, bringing all that warm water to the Arctic, is that likely to affect that mobility we're getting in the Greenland ice sheets? And I think you've answered that that's a big concern.
That is correct. However, there are other people, there are other experts who can probably address this issue much more accurately than I did.
And we hope to get Dr. James Hansen from NASA on to perhaps speak about that, or some glaciologists. Great. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me again.
We appreciate that. And I'll just pass over to Miwa to take us out from the show. Thanks to Dr. Vyacheslav Masovsky from the Department of Oceanography Naval Postgraduate School in the United States.
Okay, so you're listening to Beyond Zero News, and the latest news for today is Prime Minister Kevin Rudd yesterday attempted to clarify a statement from the Australian delegation in Bali, which said Australia fully supports an early decision for developed countries to examine cutting greenhouse gas emissions by between 25 and 40% by 2020. That stance suggested Australia was prepared to radically cut its emissions, forcing Mr. Rudd and his climate change minister, Penny Wong, to issue statements stressing that Australia was not yet committing itself to any 2020 targets. Mr. Rudd said some countries had indicated they do not necessarily accept those targets, nor do they accept those targets as binding targets for themselves. He added that this is also a position of the Australian government. But by playing down the need for Australia to commit to deeper cuts in its greenhouse gas emissions, Mr. Rudd could find himself in conflict with the leading players at the Bali talks, including China and India. The emission cuts are considered crucial by many scientists if the world is to avoid dangerous climate change. More than 200 scientists, led by Australian experts, yesterday called on nations at the Bali talks to launch an agreement that would stop the global temperature from rising by more than 2 degrees. Now, Mr. Rudd is due to attend the high-level Bali talks next week. He will be confronted by calls from the developing world, led by China, to accept that. Australia accepted in principle that developed countries must lead the way by making deep cuts to their emissions by 2020. So that's very promising there. So hopefully they will make all the cuts needed. And you're listening to Beyond Zero News, and that's the end of the show for today. If you can keep listening, next we've got Susanna with Left After Breakfast, and you listen to us next week at 8:30 Friday mornings on AM 855, and that was Beyond Zero, and thanks for listening.